stocky. Muscle manos. All right, let's start Proverbs, shall we? Proverbs 30, 7 through 9. This is a good one. On finances and happiness, or the lack thereof regarding both. 37 through 9. Somebody pick up there when you get it. So Solomon, maybe Solomon, says augur in verse 1 of chapter 30. We're not sure who that is. Could be Solomon, or it could be a compilation of Solomon's stuff. Regardless, good wisdom. Two things I ask. This is what the author says, that God, please don't refuse me. Number 1 and 8, keep deception and lies far from me. What does that mean? What is he asking God to do in his spiritual world? Yeah, he's basically saying, I'm weak and I can't handle certain things. So keep deception and lies and certain temptations far from me, because I understand my spiritual state. I understand my inability to handle these things. Keep them far from me. Also, moving on, not just from the spiritual realm, but the physical realm. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Now, many of us have prayed for the first. Most of us have not prayed for the second, right? God, please don't make me filthy rich. Please don't do that, right? No one's ever prayed that, right? Except for Solomon. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me the food that is my portion. And this is why he asks for neither one of those extremes, that I may not be full and say, full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? That would be the extreme side of wealth. Or that I may not be in want and steal and profane the name of God, right? Both of those extremes, Solomon says, are bad. One would be, I have so much that I don't need what? I have no need of you, God. I have every one of my needs met. I can pay my bills. There's food in the pantry. I can get extras. I can do whatever I want because I have the means to get it. I have no need of you. The other side of that, though, is also true. If you don't have, then what's the temptation? To steal. I don't have what I need just to meet my very basic needs, food, water, clothing, shelter. I don't have those things, so I'm tempted to sin and to steal and profane your name. So what is Solomon asking then? Where does he want to be? He wants to be middle. He wants to be average, right? This is the greatest graduation speech that you've never heard. God, make me wonderfully average, right? I have some buddies that I have the privilege of running with that are great guys. One of them is at a financial elevation that you and I can only dream of. Okay, he is the guy that we all envy and think, if I could just be that dude, my life would be great. And we were talking literally, I think it was almost a year ago today, in life group one morning, and he was sharing with us kind of his journey. He started a company from nothing. He came from absolute, utter poverty, started a company, built it up, worked insane dumb hours, slept out of the back of his car. I mean, insane, right? And then sold this company for a gazillion dollars, okay? He built Disneyland, which he calls his house, out east of town. It's amazing, off the hook. I mean, crazy, right? He is the guy that we kind of all look at and say, boy, if I could just be this dude. Got kids, wife, the whole deal, was super like into this kind of lifestyle, and his kids were like, you know, they had everything they wanted. Dad had an open checkbook, never said no, anything you want, no allowance. If you want it, you want a new dirt bike, great, here's $6,000, go get a dirt bike. You need a second dirt bike, go get another dirt, that type of lifestyle. And they started Restone after they had been there for 10 years with like, this is not what the kids want, not what the wife wants, it kind of was what he wanted. So they said, let's sell this place and downsize and do something simple. And he said, okay. So he thought, man, if I do that, surely they won't want to really do that. So I'll put the house on the market to let them know that I'll play their game, but surely they won't want to continue to go down this road. So they put the house on the market. Somebody puts an offer on it, an all-cash offer, and says, great, we'll take it. People that buy it walk through their house and, like, bought other stuff in their home. Literally, like, is that for sale? Is that for sale? I'm like, yeah, okay. So he said literally they packed, like, their underwear drawer and everything else they left, you know, that wasn't wearable and gave to this other family that bought it. Long story short, they bought, in their terms, a much more simple home and are living in town, close to friends. Dad's not working so much, and they are thrilled that they don't have all that stuff that they thought would make them happy. They've got mom and dad around much more consistently. They're living a much more moderate lifestyle now than they were a year ago, and woke up to kind of this idea that this is not ultimately what would make you happy. He said as he was moving the kids out of the house, he was going through kind of the last 10% of everything. The kids were responsible for packing their own rooms, getting everything ready to go. He said as he was walking through the rooms, his youngest daughter, he said he walked into her room and she had packed everything but just didn't have the desire to do everything, to pack it all. He said he walked in and saw a brand new motorcycle helmet that he had given her, brand new like boots and like full motorcycle kit. Like, I don't know what this stuff costs, but it just wasn't, she just left it behind in the closet. Like, it wasn't even worth it. Went into his son's room. They've got unopened Christmas presents in their closet that they didn't even bother messing with, right? They unwrapped them and were like, eh, you know, I'll keep that for later. And just all this stuff that he thought would make his kids happy, and it never did, okay? And this guy turned me on to a study that Princeton did that I thought was fascinating about money and happiness. Princeton did a study on how much money a family of four needs to be happy. And they literally surveyed income, and they served perceived in, or looked at perceived happiness based on like random questions like how often do you laugh in your home? Things like that that were accurate measures of, as best you could, of like happiness, right? What would you guess if you were to guess family of four, Fresno, California, 2015, how much money annually do you need to make to be like, where's that sweet spot? How much, what would you guys say? So, okay, so 90, or 65? 75. 75? 45. 45? 40. Dude, I heard like 200 grand last year, like, man. All right.
1.2 million.
Yeah. 1.2 mil. Okay. Thank you for at least being honest, right? Look, I'd like to know what it's like to be rich for a couple days. Sure, that'd be fun, right? He said this study was fascinating, and income was basically a bell curve, okay? And they looked at kind of both sides. If this was the Solomon side of poverty, and this was riches, he said the two sides actually mirrored each other in terms of perceived happiness, right? If you're on this side of the bell curve, right, and this was anywhere from about $30,000, by the way, and under, okay, the poverty rate in Fresno, California is like $25,000 a year for a family of four, okay? Underneath that, you're considered in poverty, okay? If you're living on this side of the bell curve, what are you worried about as a mom and a dad?
Food.
Shelter. Can I pay the electric bill? Do my kids have shoes? Like, do they have the most basic? Do we have the most basic things in life? Can they go to the dentist? Can we get the basic needs of life met, right? This is stressful. This is a stressful place to live, okay? Many of you are here, have been here, I've been here. It's hard because you're worried about the basic things of life, right? You're not asking, well, should we go to Vail or should we go to Cabo for vacation? It's, you don't ask those questions, right? So as a family of four, this is a stressful place to live, okay? Now, the opposite side of this, they found, was about $204,000 was the opposite side of the bell curve, but the people living over here had the same frustrations as the people living here and had the same perceived level of happiness. If you're making 204 grand a year as a family of four, what are your concerns? Are they, how am I gonna pay the electric bill? Probably not. Are they, hey, how am I gonna get shoes for my family? Probably not. What would you guess are those concerns? Because I know most of you probably make $204,000 a year. You know exactly what this feels like, right? What would you guess that someone that's living at that elevation and spent the time getting there, what are they worried about?
Sorry.
Take 2 years, I only work one at a time. I'm not a female, so I live in a lot of them.
Peggy.
Peggy, sorry. Thank you.
How are you going to pay our visa off?
Yeah, paying bills because you've run out of credit card charges, potentially.
Time and the burden by those around you.
Yeah, so time and...
You feel burdened for everybody else around you that's making less.
Okay.
And it's kind of like the part of feeling used but not. Like, they did something with NFL players. All of them go broke.
Yep.
Because they'll have like 14 mortgages for all their family members.
Yep.
And then the time their career's done, they're done.
You guys have never seen that 30 for 30 on NFL player or just professional athletes, and how it's fascinating. It's called broke.
Yeah.
Where would you guess you're at in the org chart
if you're making this much money in your company? Probably pretty high up. You got people underneath you, right? So there's a burden of responsibility. Are you managing employees? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you go on vacation to Vail, is your phone off? Probably not. You're texting, you're communicating, you have responsibilities. That's the idea, that there are stresses on this side of the equation that we don't always factor in. Running a business, right? My boss when I grew up was constantly worried about payroll. I painted in college and he was the head of a contracting firm, but he was always concerned about all of our employees and making sure they had paychecks. He would have to take out personal loans at times when people owed him $100,000, but he would have to put a balance on his American Express in order to pay payroll. It's just a whole different ball of wax. And we look at that and go, oh man, that'd be great. Well, the reality is these people's level of happiness, perceived happiness, was the same as those living in poverty. So they said the average bell curve, depending on where you live, was anywhere from $75,000 to $90,000 a year. That was the sweet spot to live in. So as Solomon talks about, give me neither poverty nor riches, feed me the portion that is mine, these were the people that had the greatest level of perceived happiness. Okay? Fascinating, is it not? Yeah.
Yeah, I run into a lot of that every day with like business owners, and they're just like stressed out. So like from an economy's perspective, and I know we looked at Genesis before, how as soon as it all happened, like trade started. What was the original design of like commerce? And I know that the garden was in, but in this fallen world, what would be a biblical view, I guess, of careers and business and how you handle it?
Yeah.
Especially in a world where it's not Christian based.
For sure.
And you're competing, you know, as a Christian businessman or owner,
yeah,
with someone who's very shady or.
Certainly.
You know, how do you navigate that world? Well,
I would say as we go back to the Bible and go back to Genesis specifically, God created work is good. So work is good, especially for males. We need that outlet, and God has designed us to need that type of wiring. You know, to live and work in a world where we've got to deal with non-Christian folks and rub shoulders with them. Our integrity is important, and those sorts of things obviously are paramount. But I would make the argument that God created work pre-fall that was good. And we need to make money. We have to provide for our families, right? Those type of things are biblical. Now, to get into the details of commerce and all that stuff, I don't know. But you see industry rising. You see all those things that are not bad. Culture isn't bad. Those things aren't bad. We can make them that way if we're not careful. But I don't think that's the point of the scriptures in terms of how we see work and how we're to look at it. They surveyed, by the way, the people that were making, I think it was $25,000 a year, okay? And they said, if we moved you up to $50,000 a year, if we moved you from here to here, we doubled your salary tomorrow, what would happen to your happiness level? What would you guess their answer was? I double your salary, how much happier are you going to be?
Double.
To a person, they all said double, right? And then they looked at the actual results from here to here. You know what it was? 9%. People that were in this category were 9% happier than the people that were at $25,000 a year, right? Just think about that as you guys are looking at life. Some of you are at different stages and you're pondering careers and those sorts of things. $75,000, by the way, a year. The highest paid staff member at Budrank Elementary, where my kids go to school, makes $75,000 a year. Okay, we're not talking about careers that need to be monstrosities. That's a single family, right? Many of us don't make that. But with two incomes or choosing the way to navigate that, there are ways to be creative and to make that sweet spot and to shoot for that, to where you can be a stay-at-home mom, you can raise kids, you can have a part-time job, you can work in creative ways to make that. But I think we need to get out of our heads that this idea one day is going to somehow make us happier. Studies have shown that it doesn't, and I think biblically, Solomon says, man, I just want to be average. Please don't make me rich, because I can't handle the temptations and the stress that come with it, and please don't make me poor so I'm not profaning your name and stealing and lying. Just make me wonderfully average, right? And in California, cost of living is a little bit different than it is in like Mississippi or Texas, where I'm from, right? Our dollar doesn't go quite as far. So find that range for you and be content to live in it, right? Have some luxuries, enjoy life, eat some ice cream, take your kids out for Tex-Mex, get them two pair of shoes. But enjoy life, but don't go crazy with it.
Where were these people that were surveyed? Where was the survey done?
Nationwide, 480,000 Americans across every state. Okay, so they said basically based on the range of where you live in the United States, that's kind of where the greatest perceived level of happiness was, right? For a wife, a husband, and two chitlins in a white picket fence, right? So as you guys are thinking about that, just that's an encouragement. I think this generation probably gets that more than mine and more than the ones before me. I think the idea of the American dream of owning a house and all that stuff is kind of slowly dying, if not quickly dying. I think you guys are maybe one of the first generations who truly understand, man, that's not what my life's going to be about, right? And I think that's really, really healthy and good. So I think there's a lot of us that are far down that road already, which I think is a great thing, okay? So go live in a tiny house. Go live in 600 square feet, right? My wife was watching a documentary on that the other day. She's like, I totally do that tomorrow. I'm like, all right. So, but think about it, all right? Thoughts on that?
Just share, going off of your story. I know this guy, he's 70 years old. He has kids. He has a great business. He has a business that has 30,000 payroll a week. He can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Kids don't want it.
Yeah.
Wow. He's willing to pay for it. He's in it to sustain his employees.
Right.
And maintain that going, but he wants out.
And his kids don't even want it because of the stress that comes with it. Yeah, what do you think they've watched dad do their whole life, right? It's he's probably a great guy, but yeah, you can't just shut down the machine because you're responsible for every individual. That's a lot of stress, a lot of responsibility. I have three employees, right? And it's stressful for me to think through, gosh, what if something happens and how do I, you know, it's and I have three of them. I can't imagine having a company and the responsibility the size that some of these people do, and just the stress that comes with that and the desire to provide and take care of them as best you can, right? So, okay? So, go home at 5 o'clock at night, spend time with your family, put your feet up, right? Wrestle, make memories, but don't go pursue the almighty dollar. It will disappoint you every time, all right? Cool? All right, let's pray, and then we will dive into Genesis 24. God, thanks for today, and Lord, thanks for just reminders that I know I need in my life. I'm tempted to think that, God, if I just had more money and more stuff, that I'd be happier, or that somehow my life would be less stressful if I could get these certain things, or finances just weren't an issue. And Lord, at the end of the day, it's not true. And I know my personality, like many in here, would be tempted to see that our lives are kind of self-made, that we would maybe pat our own backs, if you will, and say, God, we have no need for you. So, Lord, I pray that you would keep us far from that. And for those that maybe, God, even now are at the other end of the spectrum and are wrestling with finances and it's tight, Lord, as it is for so many of us, Lord, would you teach us contentment in the midst of that? Would you teach us how to enjoy your provisions? Would you show us how you provide in ways that, Lord, only you can? Lord, thank you for the amazing people that have hearts to give, that you've given the means to do that. I pray, Father, if there are those in here that are struggling to make the most basic needs meet, Lord, that you would bless them financially, that you would give them the means to take care of their most basic needs so that they can enjoy life and not be stressed out about the little things. So, and God, would we set our sights on the right building, if you will? Would we not climb the wrong tower thinking that somehow that would provide for us happiness and satisfaction in life? Would we be, God, as Solomon says, wonderfully average? And would we depend on you? Would you keep us in a place for the rest of our lives where we are dependent upon your provision, your shepherding of our lives, and would we submit to that joyfully, God, in all that we do? So, God, thank you for our lives, for our chance to open the book, to have schedules that allow for things like this where we can study and learn about you, God. We love you and we thank you in Christ's name. Amen. All right. Very good. Genesis 24, we left off last week. Abraham sending Eleazar, his chief servant, right, to go find a bride for Isaac. Sends him back into Padan Aram, back to Haran. And we saw kind of the beginnings of this story in chapter 24 now as Abraham is dying. In chapter 25, we will see his passing. And his last kind of earthly concern is, I need a bride for my son so that the history or the legacy can continue through now Isaac. And we saw him, Eleazar, moving to the promised land. We saw the covenant that these two men made to say, hey, don't go get a pagan wife for my dude, my boy, right? go get a godly woman from my family back in Paddan Aram, back up in Haran. And Eleazar strolls into town, comes to this well where this woman is serving along with some other folks. She, we see, is a servant. She's a camel water. She's a great woman. We see some kind of bonus stuff mentioned about her, that she's available. She's a virgin. She's a noble woman. And they're going to now have this conversation to continue kind of this line of thinking that obviously Eleazar has on his mind. Could this be the woman that God has appointed for my master's son Isaac? Okay. So 21, he is gazing at her, watching her serve. She is now offered to take care of him, to take care of his camels. 22 and following, he gets an answer as to who she is. In verse 24, she says, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. Nahor was Abraham's kin, so we know this gal is family. This is exactly the type of gal that Eleazar now is looking for her, looking for Isaac. Okay, 26, as a response to what God appears to be doing to aligning the stars. Look what now Eleazar does in 26 and 27.
Man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, blessed be, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman.
So, I'm sorry, keep going.
Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things.
All right, so she's going to go back and report to her home all that's happened, all that's transpired between these two in that conversation. In 25, she says, hey, by the way, not only am I going to feed your camels, or water your camels, rather, we have plenty of straw and feed and room to lodge you. So why don't you come home with me? We'll take care of your camels and you. You got a place to sleep. You're safe. You are welcome in our home. So this gal exhibits hospitality, all the values in that culture that Eleazar is looking for, he sees in this young, noble woman. So she's great, okay? 29, they go home. Rebecca had a brother whose name was Laban, or Laban, as we call him here in the States. Ronan rebuked me several times saying, it's not Laban, dude. I'm like, well, I'm English, so it's Laban, and I come from Texas, so that's all I got. So Laban is what we'll call him, but Laban, I guess, is how he's pronounced in Israel culture, okay? So Laban is going to be a guy that we're going to continue to see throughout the story. He is going to be Jacob, who's going to come from, obviously, this union, his Jacob's teacher for about 20 years. So just kind of tuck him away. He'll be important in the rest of the story, okay? So they basically get back. Let's pick up there in 30, kind of watch how this unfolds. So Eleazar gives all these gifts, kind of like a dowry, to Rebecca, saying, hey, my master's legit. He has the financial means. Isaac is for real. So here's a here's proof positive that what I'm about to ask of you is not insane. We're kind of backing up our word with our stuff, okay? Keep going.
He said, come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside? For I've prepared the house and a place for the camels. So the man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and water to the camels. And there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him.
You see just, again, the hospitality, that idea elevated and just what they're doing in this home. Like that, in this day and age, that's big. That is a huge, huge deal, okay? So he says in verse 34, I'm Abraham's servant. God has greatly blessed me in verse 35. My master, he's become rich. He's given flocks and herds and silver and gold and donkeys. He's got all this stuff. Sarah, my master's son, my master's wife bore a son to my master in her old age and has given all that she has now to him. Okay, my master in verse 37 made me swear. So he's basically telling the story, Eleazar is, to Laban and Bethuel, this other guy in verse 50 that's present, the father. Hey, here's what's going on. Here's why I'm here. And he recounts now this entire story. Hey, I came, I showed up at this well. I've been watching now your daughter. Here's what she's done. God has kind of led us together. And here's kind of my proposal. So he walks Laban and Bethuel through this entire picture all the way up through verse 50 and basically says, I want to take Rebecca to be now the wife for Isaac. Are you guys down with that? So they literally have just met. Dinner's cooking at this point, and they're having this level of conversation, okay? So verse 50, this is what they say.
Take her and go, and
So what do you notice about these two guys, Laban and Bethuel's response? What do you see in them from the get-go? They have faith, right? They're talking about the Lord like, hey, this is clearly from the Lord. Like, what do you want us to say? We can't say anything bad or good. This is clearly from God. So as Abraham said, look, don't take from the Canaanite people, the non-God worshipers. I don't want a wife for Isaac from there. I want a wife from the people that know the Lord. And what do you see? These people know the Lord. So Abraham's influence, as he left family in Haran, is grown. So there's a group of people there that know the Lord, which is awesome. That's what he wanted. So they say, hey, here is Rebecca. Take her and go. Like, that's insane. Like, dude, you just showed up like 20 minutes ago and told us this story, and we see God's fingerprints all over this. Take this young woman, my sister and my daughter, respective to each Bethuel and Laban, and have her. Go. Have her be now the wife of this Isaac that you speak of, okay? Keep going to verse 52. And Cassie, you really don't have to read all day. I was half teasing you the other day. Cassie was at bike repair the other day, and I told her she had to read all day on Thursday. So, and you did. You probably remember that, but you're owning it like a champ. So keep going if you like.
When Abraham's servant heard their words, God was on the earth before the Lord. And the servant brought out jewelry of silver and of gold and garments and gave them to Rebecca. He also gave to her brother and to her mother costly ornaments.
Okay, now you'll remember. So you see all these gifts given again. Eleazar's concern when Abraham sent him was what? Like, if you're going to send me to this town, and I'm going to meet this girl, I'm going to give her all this stuff, I'm going to make this request, Eleazar has a little bit of pushback for Abraham. You guys remember what it was?
What if she says no?
What if she says no? What if she won't go? And what does Abraham say?
Then you're done.
Then you're done. You're totally free from this covenant. If she won't go, meaning if she doesn't have crazy big faith in the desire to do this thing that is clearly from God, but yet big and scary, you're free from the oath. Now, we've heard from Laban. We've heard from Bethuel, her dad. Who have we not heard from? Her. We don't know what her response is. So, now watch this, okay? Brother and mom say in verse 55, hey, let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10. Afterwards, she may go. So, why would they want her now to stay for 10 additional days? Yeah, let's think about it. What else? If you know she's going to go in 10 days as her family, man, can we spend some last time with her? Can we have a party? Can we get the family together, right? Can we eat copious amounts of food? And you know what I mean? Like, let's celebrate, okay? We want some time with her, okay? So they say that, okay? Now, verse 56, what does Eleazar say? What is he basically saying? Give us 10 days. And he says, no, we're going now. Like, I don't want to delay my master. Look, your party sounds great, but we're not doing that, okay? And they say to Rebecca in verse 58, let's call the girl over and let's see what she says, okay? So she hasn't met Isaac. She's just now met Eleazar. She's been propositioned with this great opportunity. How is she going to respond, verse 58? I will go. Done. Right now. Pack up my, you know, my Samsonite and let's hit the road, right? So what do you see in this girl from the get-go?
Faith.
Man, she's got faith, right? She's a servant. She's godly. She's got faith. She's willing to abandon her family to go where God wants her to go. I mean, this is big. This is significant in terms of the faith of this woman. We don't get a ton on Rebecca, but this is a godly woman, okay? So we need to rightly exalt her. 59, they sent her away with a nurse, Abraham's servant and his men. They blessed Rebekah and said in verse 60, may you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. So what do they see ultimately she's going to be? What does it mean that may you become thousands of 10,000s? Yeah, land, seed, and blessing. They see her as the fulfillment of that promise. You were going to be the seed. It's going to go from Sarah to you. You are going to be the womb that's going to continue the blessing of God, okay? So we see this is a huge blessing, and they see this, okay? Rebecca rose in verse 61. They mounted their camels. He follows the man. The servant took Rebecca and departed, okay? Now, Rest of the story happening back home in verse 62. Watch what Isaac is doing.
Now Isaac had returned from Beer-Lahai-Roy.
Sure.
He was dwelling in the Negev.
All right, so he lives down south in the Negev. We talked about that in Beersheba area, and we'll see that crystallized by Isaac with the digging of a well here in the next chapter. But that's where they're at. Okay.
And Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening. And
by the way, what's Isaac praying about right there? He's going out to the field.
High.
Yeah, like, oh, Lord, is she coming? Oh, man, I pray she's great. I pray she's this. I pray she's that. I hope she's humble. I hope she's a servant. You know what I mean? He's out there. It's a great picture of prayerful expectations on God, right? He's praying, and he's got one eye open. Is that Eliezer coming? No. Okay. You know, so he's thinking about it. He knows what's coming. This guy's been on, weeks, if not months, away from the house to get Rebecca. And here she comes. He lifted up his eyes, and behold, he looked. Camels were coming. Okay, 64.
And Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself.
What other just quality do you see in Rebecca there?
Bashful
is probably a...
Modest,
yeah. Like she's you see modesty displayed by her. Who is that? That's my master. That's Isaac. That's your future husband. She veils herself out of modesty. So you just see so many great qualities about this woman that are just exalted in this text. Okay, 66. The servants told Isaac all the things that he had done. So these two come together. The story is shared, and then in verse 67, watch what happens. So they two become one, right? They formalize this union. They are husband and wife and live happily ever after, kind of. So, not so much. Yeah.
When Eleazar says that Isaac is his master, like, are Abraham and Isaac both his master?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because he's a servant to the household. So as Abraham dies, he would continue on the role with the patriarch of the family. Absolutely. Okay. So, beautiful picture, okay? I don't know that 24 was written so that we learn anything about dating per se. I don't know that that was the intent, but boy, you see some great, just some great nuggets on types of people, how marriages go down. Obviously in this day and age, arranged marriages were the way they went, and obviously today are still very popular in some cultures. I'm becoming more and more of a fan of arranged marriages with three daughters at home. So anyway, we were sitting out last night, the night before last, by the fire and talking, and I was trying to get my youngest daughter to sign yet another marriage covenant, and she wouldn't. So, no.
Did you post one on Facebook?
That was my oldest daughter. Yeah, it's on. You can go read it. So, yeah, when my kid was six, we were having a conversation, and she said something along, "Well, Daddy, you can pick my husband." I said, "Really?" I said, "Will you write that down?" She said, "Sure." So she wrote it down in this big old six-year-old handwriting, and then I signed it, Michelle signed it, Jared Rumley signed it, Judd Rumley signed it, another pastor signed it. I'm like, it's official. So the four of us were sitting outside. Our middle kid was gone. So it's me and Michelle, Madison, who signed the contract, and my youngest, Ella, who's 9, 10. And we're talking about this, and she's like, "Daddy, you're going to hang it over my head." And Madison's like, "Don't sign it. It's going to be on Facebook." And I'm like, "No, it won't." "Yeah, it will." Yeah, you know, so Ella was smart enough not to sign it. But anyway, so I would be a fan of this. So, and statistically speaking, I understand arranged marriages last longer and are better statistically than non-arranged marriages. So it would, I'm telling you. So, yeah. We'll talk about that more as we get into the book of Ruth. But there are some necessary components to that to happen, and our society lacks many. So anyway, for what it's worth, there you go. So beautiful chapter on this arranged marriage. Okay, 25 now, we're going to see the first father. We're now going to see Abraham die. Okay, in 25, 1 through 4, we see Abraham now take a second wife. Keturah is her name, and he has other sons with this wife. Okay. I forget how many, it's like 5 or 6, but he has other offspring, okay? So he's got a larger family, and we don't see a rebuke guy by God per se. Sarah's dead, so I'm not sure, you know, the ins and outs of this, but it's just, it's mentioned. So he's got a bigger clan. But, verse 5, Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. So in terms of the heir, in terms of who is going to get the blessing, it's very clear from Abraham, my kid, my son Isaac, gets everything. Okay, now he takes care of his wives and his concubines, as they're called in verse 6. He gives them gifts while they're still living. But he had sent Isaac eastward to the land of the east. Okay, so he blesses his son. And in verse 7, Abraham now dies at 175 years old. So Sarah was 137. Abraham now is 175. Abraham breathed his last in verse 8, died at a ripe old age, an old man satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. Wouldn't that be a great verse to put on your tombstone? I died satisfied with life and was gathered to my people. Like, man, that's, he lived a great life without regret. Looks in the rearview mirror and says, man, that's how I want it to be. Okay. And notice, by the way, where he is buried. Verse 9. The cave, Machpelah, right? End of verse 10, with his wife, Sarah. So the burial plot that he bought was not just for her, it was also for him, and we're going to see the rest of his sons and some of their wives buried there as well. Okay, so that is a big deal. Okay, 12 and following, we get the genealogy of Ishmael. Okay, God said, hey, this is not the chosen kid, but I am going to bless him. He's going to be a huge nation, and there are 12 sons that come from him. We won't read all of them. But you see that this kid is indeed blessed. He has a huge family. We read this a little bit before, kind of talked about where he ends up living east of his brothers in kind of the lower portion of the Dead Sea. That was kind of his stomping grounds. Verse 17, these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt. As one goes toward Assyria, he settled in defiance of his relatives. Some of your Bibles may say east of his relatives. There's an interesting theme, by the way, in Scripture of being east as being kind of a theme of defiance, and that's why those words are somewhat interchangeable. Any of you guys like old school film fans, that movie East of Eden with James Dean, that was kind of the theme of the movie, of living in rebellion and defiance to the things of God. That's where kind of the theme of that movie came from. Okay, so Abraham's dead. Ishmael's dead. Sarah's dead. We've got a surviving son, Isaac, okay? And in 19 and following, we're going to see how does this work? How does this promise that God gave to Abraham in chapter 12, what happens to this? Because at this point, do we have land, seed, and blessing fulfilled? No. We got Achid, right, to the father of the nations, the father of many. We have a cave that's owned in like the midst of these Canaanite people. And he's been a blessing, but boy, the fulfillment in total of this covenant has certainly not taken place. So will this get handed down to Isaac? Are these truths that Abraham believes are going to outlive him indeed going to happen? Okay, chapter 25, verse 19. Let's look at that.
Aramean,
there you go.
Put on wrong.
Yep.
The sister of Laban.
Look at you. You're Jewish now.
To be his wife.
All right. So we're seeing the line continue. Okay. Verse 21. What's going on?
And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren.
Now, what do you notice? Just notice the things that are continuing. What is Rebecca's condition? Just like her matriarch, Sarah. Barren, right? Fascinating that God would continue to choose barren women to raise up a nation, but that's so like God. So we've got this barren woman. Isaac prays on behalf of his wife, and what happens?
And the Lord granted his prayer.
Keep going.
And Rebecca, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, If it is thus, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord.
All right, now stop for just a second. So we've got children within her. She's going to have twins. Now, we talked about this idea of sovereign election with Isaac and Ishmael, okay? We're going to see that again here, but this is a very different picture, okay? Read in verse 23 what God says about the two kids that are in her womb.
And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger.
Okay, so what does God say prior to the birth of these two kids? They're not even out of the womb yet. What is his prediction or command or whatever you want to call it?
They're going to be at odds.
They're going to be at odds, obviously. Yep, so they're going to be in tension with one another. Who are these two kids, by the way? Esau and Jacob. Okay, who is the older? Esau. Jacob's going to be the younger. And these are going to be, you talk about polar opposite personalities. We'll look at them in a second. They could not be more different. However, what does God say about birth order and who's going to get the blessing? The older shall serve the younger. Now, what have these kids done? Have they performed and done something? Has one of them made God mad and God says, well, I can't do that? Has one of them been born from an Egyptian maidservant, so I can't possibly choose that one, like he couldn't with Ishmael, right? That's the argument that you could make. You talk about pure, sovereign, electing purposes of God. He's going to say, before they're even out of the womb, before they can even do anything good or bad, I've already chosen. Jacob is going to be the one that receives the blessing, and the older brother Esau will serve him. The Edomites are going to come from Esau. Jacob will now continue the line of Israel, and those are the two nations now that are struggling within the womb. So you see God's sovereign electing purposes here. And by the way, as you guys read through Romans with Shay, the argument in Romans chapter 9 of sovereign election, Paul is going to use this illustration to say, God can do whatever the heck God wants to do because he's God. And this is the illustration that they're going to go back to. Malachi 1 says, Jacob I have loved and Esau I have hated. Strong language used in Malachi. The idea is not love, hate in terms of how we would look at it. It's a chosen, not chosen. I have chosen Esau. Or Jacob, I have not chosen Esau. It doesn't mean that he doesn't love Esau or that he doesn't love the non-elect, because God clearly does, but he's saying my love for and my choosing of the elect is different than the non-elect. So here in the midst of Genesis, you see one of the clearest pictures of God's sovereign electing purposes in the midst of us rolling through that. Okay, so make note of that, all right? Watch what else continues, verse 24. Okay, so red, or Esau literally means red. Okay, this guy makes, he was hairy over his entire body, out of the womb. Okay, so just keep that in mind. This guy is, that's pretty hairy. I've seen some kids come out with a full head of hair. I've never seen kids come out that were like goats, right? Yeah, literally. So Shay used to say that his family made Darwin proud, like they had that much body hair. Shay's older brother was walking on a beach one time, and somebody asked him why he was wearing a sweater. Ooh. That's a lot of hair. So, yeah. So, unbelievable. So, yeah. Anyway. So, that's Esau. Okay. Think Shay's older brother. That's Esau. Okay. He's not here, so we can make fun of him. All right. You can ask Shay about that story. You didn't hear it from me. 25. Keep going. Or 26.
Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel. So, his name was called Jacob.
Okay. Jacob literally means supplanter or heel catcher. Trickster is kind of the name. That's where that comes from. So you've got the red one, and you've got the trickster. And these are going to be the names, literally, that they are going to live up to. Okay? So we'll see kind of how that unfolds. Now, 29 and following, I'll keep going in 27 first, actually.
When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob.
So paint a picture for me of these two sons now as they grow. What's Esau like? Yeah, he's the jock, he's the hunter, he's the man's man, he's Bear Grylls, right? He hunts, he kills food, he eats food, right? That's Esau, right? He's the guy that we all would have liked, right? He's that type of personality, he's a dude, he's the picture child of what a man is supposed to be like, right? Hunts, fishes, plays baseball, right? That's Esau. Now, what's Jacob? Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Modern-day translation is, he's a mama's boy, okay? He's a bit of a sissy. He lives inside. My brother's out hunting. He wants to have cooking lessons. He has soft hands, right? He's not a real manly dude. He doesn't like that kind of stuff. So not that there's anything wrong with either, but you just see a very clear picture of, these two brothers are very, very different, okay? Esau's going to live life according to his stomach, right? Me hungry, me need food. Like, that's Esau's world. Jacob has got the intelligence. He's He's conniving. He's a trickster. He's smart. But who's the one that God said from the get-go is going to get the blessing? Is this clear to the family? Yes. God says to, it says in verse 23, her. Rebecca knew this, and we're assuming that very clearly because of the importance of this. Isaac knew this as well. So there's not a mystery as to which kid is supposed to get the blessing, which is well, we'll see that it formalized in a way that Abraham didn't quite do it. Isaac's going to do it with a verbal, a binding agreement, okay? And we'll see that unfold, okay? So they understand that. But who does Isaac like? Who does he favor?
Esau,
right? Why? He gets along with him. He does the stuff that Isaac likes to do, right? I understand that in my world. I like to be out in the garage of my three kids. There's one of them that likes to go out in the garage with me, right? Sometimes, like, I'm changing the oil in my car. One of my kids is like, I want to learn how to change the oil. I'm like, awesome, let's do that. And we're crawling underneath the truck and doing stuff like that. And my other kids are like, that's dumb, right? I'm going to go, you know, make paper mache stuff, you know, with my girlfriends or whatever. It's just you have natural inclinations to certain kids. And as parents, if you're not careful, it can be perceived as favorites. Isaac, like, doesn't care. He's like, nope, that's my favorite very clearly. And I'm going to violate the known will of God to give you the blessing because that's what I want. Who does Rebecca like?
Jacob,
okay? Jacob had cooked stew. Where does it say that? Peaceful man living in tents. But Rebecca, end of verse 28, loved Jacob. So there are clear favorites. One's a mama's boy. One's a daddy's boy. They're both played favorites, and now that puts mom and dad at odds with one another. It's an odd, difficult situation. Okay, so these men are older. We're fast-forwarding through their life pretty quick here. 29, Jacob had been cooking stew in with mama. Esau had been out hunting. He comes in, and he's hungry. And Esau now says to Jacob in verse 30.
Oh, sorry. Once Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted. Therefore, his name was called Edom. Jacob said, sell me your birthright now. Esau said, I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?
So this is a crazy, like, so Esau comes in and he's hungry. So he's been hunting and maybe he's really hungry. I don't know, okay? And Jacob's been making dinner and he says, let me have some of your stew. And he says, well, I'll give you my stew, but first I want your birthright. What is a birthright? What is he asking for? I want your inheritance. I want to swap places with you. I want to be the firstborn. Now, what had God already said in terms of this birth order? Why would Jacob want the firstborn spot? Well, he is the younger. So what has he already been guaranteed? He's been guaranteed the rights of the older, right? You are the firstborn, even though you're the secondborn. So what do you think the family dynamic was in terms of who was going to get the blessing in reality, even though God had said something different, right? Do you think Jacob feels like clearly dad's going to give me the rights of the firstborn? No. So he's trying to acquire it by any means necessary. And he's being Jacob. He's being deceptive here. Yeah, Jacob.
how are we so certain that Rebecca told Isaac and therefore Esau of this choosing by God?
Yeah,
I think that's why she loved Jacob.
Maybe that's a possibility. As big as this is, when God speaks to you prior to them having kids, I think Jacob would have been aware of that. 21, he's praying on behalf of his wife because she's barren. Then they have this conversation. So was he present in verse 23? I'm not sure, but it sure seems like he would know that. And he's working really, really hard to make this not happen. Where if it was assumed that the older is going to get the birthright, why would Isaac need to be deceptive? And you're going to see him be deceptive in this next chapter as well. So it's a bit of an assumption, but I think it's a pretty safe one.
The fact that it's written down and it was like an oral tradition thing probably proves that at least at some point they knew these things.
Yeah, so I got to think that Isaac understood that. I mean, this would be a pretty big thing to keep quiet. So there you go. So they're trying to exchange this idea of birthright, which would have been the blessing, obviously, and all the stuff in the lineage that came with being the firstborn. Okay, so Esau says, man, I'm about to die. What use do I have for a birthright? Verse 30. I don't care. Take it. Okay, so Verse 30, for swear to me, he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. Now, remember that. He willingly gave it to Jacob. Now, Esau is going to interpret this story very differently in the years to come. Okay, so he's like, great, give me some stew. So again, you see a guy that's driven by the here and now, my stomach, my flesh. I want my flesh fulfilled now. In 5 minutes, he's going to be full, but he's already sold his birthright, right? So you see a guy that's very carnal, very much like his father, Isaac. We see them leave. How old is They're in their probably late teens, early 20s. Isaac's gonna leave.
Like reading it, it sounds like so absurd that somebody would sell their birthright for some food from their family. Like, could it be that it was kind of like a joke that was like became really serious?
No, this is not a joke. This is your birthright is everything in this culture. So. It's your inheritance here, but we don't even really have that to the same degree. I don't know what you even compare this to. This is a big deal. So the fact that Esau is so nonchalant about, like, yeah, who cares? Like, for a bowl of lentil stew, like, that stuff's nasty. Like, get a steak out of the deal or something, right? So it says a lot about who he is, what he values, those sorts of things, okay? So 20 or 34, Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate and drank, arose, went on his way, and Esau despised his birthright. You see in there his whole attitude about this entire situation. Okay. Now 26, watch what else continues in the story of God with the patriarch through Isaac. 26:1.
Now there was a famine in the land besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham.
All right, so have we seen this before? Absolutely, the family of God being tested, okay? So Isaac gets up, he goes to Gerar, which is that city west of them, Philistine city. The king of the Philistines, Abimelech, is there. And watch what God says now to Isaac. And here's kind of where I get my theology on Abraham in terms of leaving and going to Egypt.
And the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws.
Awesome. So what do you notice God says to him? You cool to go to Egypt? Because that's where he was on his way to. It's what it looked like. What does he say? No. Why? Why does he want Isaac to stay? What is this an issue of?
What points to the promise?
Yeah. Do you trust me, Isaac? Do you trust that I will take care of you like I took care of your dad? This is the first time, by the way, that we see, and maybe Isaac has seen, God clearly say, this didn't die. My covenant did not die with your dad. It extends to you. I will take care of you. You are going to get land and seed and blessing. So stay here and let me take care of you. Does that make sense? So ultimately, this is an issue of faith for Isaac. Do you trust me to feed your family, or are you going to flee to Egypt? I don't want you to go. I want you to stay here. Okay, so I think, I'm presuming a little bit again, that is what he wanted of Abraham. Stay. I've given you a promise. I'm not going to break my promise. Okay, and who does God swear by? Verse 5. Maybe not swear by. Who is this? Who does he lean on to say why he's going to keep this? Abraham, right? I swore this to Abraham, right? I will keep my word. And we're going to see that all throughout God's promises. He's going to continue to go back and he'll say, by what I said to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and I will do these things because I've committed my word. I'm not going to go back on my word. Even though it hasn't fleshed itself out yet, I will keep my promises.
So on the covenant that God made with Abraham, we've talked about it being a unilateral covenant. Mm-hmm. So why in verse 5 does it say, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge and all those things?
I think you're seeing chapter 22 fleshed out. You're seeing Abraham demonstrated faith by his offering of you. So he's pointing back to Abraham's great faith. I don't think we see too many times it being unilateral for it to be dependent upon one act. But I think he is pointing to, look, your dad had great faith. Have great faith like your dad did. And he demonstrated that in the hardest point of his life. So that's kind of how I interpret that. Okay. So verse 6, what does Isaac do? Lived in Gerar. Okay, so he doesn't go to Egypt. Attaboy. Okay, so good. So he lives in faith and stays, and God has to provide for him. Verse 7, like father, like son.
When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," for he feared to say, "My wife," thinking, "Lest the man of the place should kill me because of Rebecca, because she was attractive in appearance."
How about that? So what does he wrestle with? Same thing daddy did. So how did he grow up? What type of home did he see? What type of environment did he see as to that being a normative process? Remember, we saw it in the text twice, but it seems like this was a normative practice for Abraham. Hey, when we travel, when we leave Fresno, we're no longer husband and wife, right? And when we're in Madtown, you're my sister, because I'm afraid of those crazy people up in Madera, right? They got weird pastors up there and stuff. It could get bizarre. So don't tell anybody that you're my wife. And that's what he grew up under. So he says, we're going to do the same thing. Like, I got to save my skin, and that's how we're going to live. So he instructs Rebecca to lie, and that's what they do, okay? And problem is, verse 8. What does your say laughing with?
Yeah.
Mine says caressing. So the idea is they're doing something brother and sister don't do. Like, that is not normal. That is not your sister. And I done saw it with my own two eyes. That's what he's saying. Like, you're not laughing. There is something happening that just crossed a line. And from that, I get that you clear that, you know, this ain't Arkansas. So this is not your sister. So I'm teasing. So he basically is caught being affectionate with his wife, right? And Abimelech says, man, what have you done? Like, other people may have easily lain with your wife and would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech charged all his people, saying, hey, stay away from this woman. He who touches this man, in verse 11, shall surely be put to death, he or his wife. So leave them alone. So he gets rebuked again, different Abimelech, but same story. The non-Christian calling the Christian to live accountable, to live morally, he gets rebuked. And just like his dad, watch what happens as a result of him lying. Verse 12.
And Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold. The Lord blessed him, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy.
Man, like, you lie and you get rich and blessed. Man. So that's not obviously a direct, but you get the idea that he was rebuked and now he lives in the land. God says, I'm going to bless you. He blesses him, and Isaac's story, unfortunately, is a bit of a fast forward. So, you know, we saw Abraham ultimately go back home to the oak at Moreh, repent, build an altar, say, God, I'm sorry. We assume that the same process worked with Isaac, that he probably got right with God, repented, but he stays in the land, and God blesses him just like God said he would do, okay? He's got great possessions, and then in verse 15, the issues of water are going to come up just like they did in Abraham's day. Look at verse 15. Man, that's dirty, by the way, right? Your wells are your life. So when someone stops them up with dirt, that's dirty, literally and figuratively, right? They just cut off your water supply. That is like the worst thing that you can do to a people. You're basically saying, I hope you all die, right? We're going to stop up your water supply. So watch what happens. All right, so Isaac now returns to the place where his dad lives, redigs the same wells that his dad dug, right? So if you know where there's water in the desert, that's smart, dig the same wells. And he renames them the same thing that his dad had called them, the same name of the well, okay? There was a guy that did some great preaching on this verse, and he talked about the idea that Christians don't need new things. They need to unearth the old things, go back and be old school. And that's what Isaac's doing, right? He's bringing up old truth, if you will, right? He knows where the water is. He digs in those things, and he's calling on the heritage of his father, what his dad had named those wells, and says, these are from my family. These are mine. But, verse 19, Isaac's servants dug a valley dug in the valley, found there a well flowing with water. The herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, that water is ours. It's like, really? Like, dude, I still got a shovel in my hand. I've been digging all day, and now you're going to say that water is, how is that water yours? Right, well, this is our land and whatever. So they named the well Essek, which means contention. They dig now another well in verse 21. They named it Sitnah, which means enmity. So you're seeing this strife between Isaac and the non-Christian that he's living around. And who's the one that's continuing to have to flex? Isaac. Okay, take the well. I'll dig another one. Okay, this one's mine. No, it's not. That's ours. Okay, I'll leave and I'll go dig another one now.
What would you say that one was called?
In 20, it's called Essek, E-S-E-K, because they contended with him. It literally means contention. So in 20, they named the first well Essek, the second one Sitnah, and in verse 21, which means enmity. So they're having, he basically names them fighting and quarreling, you know, basically. That's the picture that we're getting as he's living in the land, okay? 22, he moved away from there, dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he named it Rehoboth, for he said, at last the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. Rehoboth means plenty of room. So God is now finally blessing him. They're living at peace with their neighbors, and he has now water for his family. He can raise them there, okay? 23, he went up from there to Beersheba, same place where Abraham had kind of planted his roots. And watch who shows up in verse 24.
And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham your father. Fear not, I am with you, and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake.
You see a piece of what you saw in Abraham's life. So Isaac has just come off of kind of a difficult season of water and digging and contention and difficulty with the people he's trying to live around. And as soon as he's kind of through that season, who shows up in verse 24? And what does he communicate? Why would God communicate what he does now?
A reminder.
Look, dude, I'm not gone. I'm not absent. I'm still here, and I'm still going to bless you. I'm still going to fulfill my promise. And that promise is not always going to be rose-petaled paths. So get used to this. My promise includes difficulty. It includes mountaintops, and it includes valleys. So your life is not going to look easy just because I'm blessing you. Okay, it's going to be hard, and God says don't freak out when that happens. I will be faithful. 25, the first time we see this in Isaac's life, this is cool.
So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there, and there sat Isaac's servants dug a well.
Okay, where do they build this well? What city are we in? Beersheba. I mean, that city's still there today, and there's still an active well 4,000 years later. Fascinating. So that's the story of Isaac and his faithfulness. Okay, so we're seeing God blessing this man despite himself at times, and yet continuing the promise that he gave to his father Abraham. Okay, Abimelech now comes in verse 26 and says, "Hey, we need to make an agreement. God is blessing your socks off. We want to live in peace." Verse 28: "Let there be a covenant between the two of us. We're not going to do each other harm." In verse 29: "Let's make sure that we live in good community, an open relationship with one another, okay? You are blessed of God, and we want to live rightly with you." Verse 30, Isaac now makes them a feast, and they ate and drank. Abimelech and his people, Isaac and his people now make a covenant to live in honesty and community with each other, just like Abraham and the former Abimelech had done. And Isaac now in verse 31 departed from there. Abimelech departs from there, and they live now in peace together. So what was full of contention and disputes over wells and water rights is turned into a good existence for Isaac and his people, and they are living in peace. Okay, 33, they build more wells. Sheba is the first one in Beersheba, and we see kind of that lineage continue. Okay, in 34 and 35, last two verses of the chapter, we get a little nugget on Esau and what's happening in his life. Why would that be? What do you notice about Esau's wife choices? Or should I say wives?
They're Hittite.
Who are the Hittites? Because remember the sons of Heth that Abraham bought the cave of Machpelah from? Same people, okay? Are they worshippers of Yahweh? Nope, okay? Does he take two wives? Yeah, like the heck with you. You want me to take one, I'll take two, right? This is this is, it smacks of Lamech, who said, you think I, you know, you avenge Cain sevenfold, how about me 77, and I'll take seven wives. Like, I will disobey more than anyone has thus far. So Isaac sees his son now take two wives, two pagan wives, and it grieves Isaac and Rebekah. He's going to take more wives after this to further displease his parents, almost in defiance of what he knows to be right. So it's a tough chapter, and you're seeing Esau's hard, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it kind of mentality rise to the surface. He's going to go to Ishmael and marry some of Ishmael's offspring, and he's going to have multiple wives from them as well. So as Isaac is trying to live right, and Jacob is kind of in the midst of this life, Esau is kind of blowing off the ordinances of God and marrying women that he shouldn't be marrying, and marrying too many of them at that. Okay, so no bueno. Now, 27. 27 is a train wreck. Okay, it is a divine comedy. Everybody in the chapter is in sin to a person. God is not mentioned in a right way. He's mentioned in a you'll see. But it's a train wreck. This is the family of God, and we're going to see their story unfold, and it is an utter disaster of a chapter, and yet God is still in it, and God is still going to bring about his will through people that are lying, that are deceptive, that are dishonest, that take God's name and manipulate it for their own personal gain, and yet God is still going to be glorified in the midst of this. So how about that? 27:1. Let's watch now what's happening. All right, so interpret that for me. What's this conversation between Isaac and Esau?
Just wanting like a last meal.
Yeah, I want a last meal, right? What's important is my stomach, and before I can do anything spiritual, I got to eat, right? So you can see again, why does Esau identify so readily with Isaac or vice versa? Because they're both the same. They're both fleshly in that sense. So he says, go cook me something. Go hunt and go cook it and bring me back a meal. And at the end of that, what am I going to do? I'm going to bless you. What does that mean? Yeah, I'm going to give you the inheritance. You're going to receive the blessing of the firstborn, okay? You're like, pardon, Isaac? Like, I think at this point you should understand that that's not how God wants this to go down. And Isaac says, I don't really care. I want to bless Esau, and I'm going to bless Esau, okay? Rebekah, verse 5, is listening to this whole conversation and goes, uh-oh, that's not good. That's clearly not the person that's going to get blessed. He's not my favorite son. Jacob's my favorite son, so we got to figure out now, how do we get Jacob blessed? Okay. What condition, by the way, is Isaac in? What do you notice in the first four verses of chapter 27?
Blind.
He's blind. He can't see. Like maybe a little bit of light, but he can't make out much of anything. So, and he's literally on his deathbed. So he's saying, I don't know when I'm going to die. It could be in 10 minutes. So we got to get this blessing done. So Rebekah says to Jacob in verse 6, behold, I heard your father say these things to Esau. Get me some game, go cook it. I'm going to bless you before my death. And she says now in verse 8, now therefore, my son, listen to me. Here's what you're going to do. Jacob, go out to the flock, bring me two choice young goats in verse 9, that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father. Then you shall bring it to your father, that he may eat, so that he may bless you before his death. So she knows something as well. Look, you want to talk to dad, you feed him first, right? That's kind of how it is in my household as well, unfortunately. So I'm really not spiritual when blood sugar is low. So I understand this world very well, so hopefully all the rest of the train wreck that comes with it isn't a part of my life, but I certainly get that, okay? So ladies, remember that. Way to a guy's heart is through his stomach, okay? Much more spiritual, much more ready to talk about feelings and other things like that, okay? Jacob says to his mom, okay, that's what we're going to do, but Esau's a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. Like, literally, my brother's like an ape, and I am, like, the opposite of that. So he's got a lot of hair. We're pretty easy to tell apart. You don't even need to see us to realize this is not the same kid. So perhaps my father will feel me, and I will be as a deceiver. I will be a Jacob in his sight, and I will bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing. Mom, how do we handle that? Okay, so mom says, verse 15, read that. This is their solution to this problem with him not being hairy enough.
Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son.
So first thing she does is what? Dresses him in Esau's clothes, and then verse 16.
And the skin
I mean, I don't know how hairy a goat is, but when you're wearing goat skin on your neck and on your arms, and your dad goes, oh, yeah, that's you. Like, dude, that is a hairy man, right? Holy cow. So this guy is hairy, and he's red. So Jacob's clothes, or Esau's clothes on Jacob, goat skin on the back of his neck and his arms, okay? She gave him the savory food, and now Jacob is going to go into his dad and say, verse 18, my father. And he says, here I am. And he says, who are you, my son? And Jacob now says to his dad in verse 19, says to Isaac, I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done what you told me. I went out and hunted game. So he tells his dad this ginormous lie, okay? And Isaac's a little bit, something's going on. He's discerning that something's not right. How is it, my son, that you have acted so quickly? And Jacob says, because the Lord your God has caused it to happen to me. Like, I am in sin up to my eyeballs, and it's God who is doing this, right? So here's Jacob living a life of deceit and dishonesty, and yet thinking that God is somehow blessing his life. Like, no, God is not blessing this. Now, God's accomplishment will happen. Jacob is going to get the blessing. We know that. But God does not want to bless him through these means. You think God could have gotten Jacob the blessing that he wanted Jacob to have through non-sinful means, right? This is not Malcolm X theology. By any means necessary is not God's heart. But that's how Jacob and that's how Rebecca are kind of handling the situation. Like, look, whatever we need to do what God said is what we're going to do. That is horrible theology. So at some point, they need to stop, and someone would have been great to pray or maybe say, Lord, what do you want us to do? You never see that happen in this chapter, okay? So again, Isaac's suspicious, but not so much that he's actually going to, he's still going to be fooled, okay? Verse 20, we see Jacob's response. Isaac now says, please come close, in verse 21, that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not, okay? Keep going, 22. Okay, look at verse 27. When he came close, he kissed him, and when he smelled the smell of his garments, what do you notice that Isaac is using to discern, is this Jacob or Esau? Senses. His eyes, what he can feel, and what he can smell. What do you notice he's not using? What else?
Sight.
Lord, is this who you want it to be? These are all fleshly things, yes? Eyes, ears, feel. There's no spiritual element to any of this. God, is this my son? Lord, is this the person you want me to choose? Like, he is a fleshly, carnal guy, just like Esau. You see how this family dynamic must have been odd and hard and difficult? And you see the heart of Isaac. He's not... God loves him and God's using him, but you don't see maybe some of the maturity factors that we saw in Abraham's life. This guy is fleshly, and he's wanting to bless his fleshly son. And he confirms it. I've felt it. I've smelt it. Sorry, I just had a like third grade thought in my head. I dealt it. Sorry. Welcome to my head. And he says, that's the guy. So in verse 27 now, he gives a statement. This is the first time we've seen this in this format. What Isaac is about to communicate, it's verbal, but it is binding. It is like you're signing your will in the presence of a lawyer, and you're saying, thus it shall be, and it can never be changed. So when Isaac communicates this now to who he thinks is Esau, which is really Jacob, there are no takebacks. Okay, so 27, watch what he says. Does that sound like a pretty good lineage, pretty good blessing? May you get all the stuff. May everybody bow down to you. May your mother's sons bow down to you. So who's getting the blessing? In Isaac's mind? Esau, I'm giving everything I have to the firstborn son, just like God told me not to do. Like, wow, like this, the defiance of Isaac, of Esau, Jacob and Rebekah are no better in that they're lying to get what they got, but Jacob, or rather Isaac, fully thinks that he is blessing Esau at this point. And he says, you get everything. And as sure as it's done, verse 30, as soon as Isaac had finished speaking to Jacob, Jacob left. He had hardly left the presence of Isaac when his brother Esau comes back in from hunting. He makes a savory dish for his father, comes into the room and says, Father, bless me. 32, Isaac says, who are you? And he says, I am your son, your firstborn son Esau. Like, really this time. And he says, oh, man. Who is that brought me all the tasty game and all the stuff that I just ate and I blessed? And Esau heard the words in verse 34 of his father. He cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me even also my father. And he said, your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing. So whose fault is this? Is this Isaac's fault? Nope. Let's pass the buck. It was your brother's fault. He came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing. Well, maybe that's actually how God wanted it to go down. And Isaac, maybe you actually have a role to play in this. So here you see even a dad who's not owning up to his responsibility. You talk about like manhood, rejecting passivity, accepting responsibility. Isaac does neither. It's your brother's fault. And he says, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. Look at what Esau says. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. Really? How did that story go down exactly, Esau? Did he take your birthright from you? No. How did Jacob end up with the birthright? You gave it to him freely of your own volition, right? Now, you were hungry, and he deceived you, but he took nothing from you. You gave it, and you gave it willingly.
What's the difference between a birthright and a blessing?
Same. The blessing came with the birthright. The birthright was basically saying, I am the firstborn. Yeah. As a result of that, I get the blessing of the firstborn. Okay. So they're synonymous. Okay? That's the idea. So he took away the blessing. So again, Esau, same thing. Won't accept responsibility. This is Jacob's fault. He's rightly called Jacob because he's a heel catcher, a supplanter, a deceiver, right? That is his namesake, and that's exactly what he's done. Isaac replied to Esau, behold, I have made him your master and all his relatives. In verse 37, I've given to his servants and grain and wine and sustained him. Like, I can't undo this. I've said it, and it's done. So as we see these promises communicated by the patriarch on their deathbed, these are big. They are significant. They are binding. They are legal. You cannot undo them. And even in Isaac's desire, right, you know with his personality, even at this point, if he could undo it, he probably would really like to. But he realizes there's nothing I can do, okay? So Esau says, do you have only one blessing in verse 38? Bless me also, okay? This is the blessing now that Isaac gives to Esau, the one he wanted to give to Jacob, 39 and 40. Like, that is not a blessing. That is not positive, right? Away from here, away from the fertility of the earth, you're going to live in want and difficulty. And that's what I wanted for Jacob. I wanted to give you the blessing. But this is what he now gives to Esau, right? The hairy one that's going to live to the east. He's going to live down south as well with the Ishmaelites kind of down in that area. And it's going to be difficulty. And one day you will break the yoke that your brother has put on your neck. So, difficult passages, difficult family situation, okay? 41 now, watch how Esau responds to this. He is mad.
Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are approaching, then I will kill my brother Jacob.
So we're going to have a funeral for my dad, and then we're going to have a funeral for my brother. That's what he says. I'm going to kill him. So, boy, we're back to like Cain and Abel type days. Like, there is difficulty and tension. And Esau is so angry. And it doesn't appear that he's just like popping off in a moment of like, man, I'll kill you. Like, he's serious. And Rebekah hears that and says, holy cow. Verse 42, word gets back to Rebekah that he says that. And he realizes, man, Jacob versus Esau, that's a pretty easy battle, right? You got mama's boy and Bear Grylls. Like, this is a blood match, right? It's going to be bad. So she says, hey, Jacob, you got to get out of town. Like, you got to leave now. So here's what you're going to do. Verse 34, my son, obey my voice. Arise and flee to Haran, to my brother Laban. Okay? Go back to my hometown. Go meet my brother Laban. Stay with him a few days until your brother's fury subsides. Let Esau calm down. Stay there a few days and then come back and all will be fine until your brother's anger against you subsides in verse 45, until he forgets what you did to him. Then I will send and get to you. Once he's mellowed out, I'll send and you'll come back. Okay? Verse 46, Rebecca said to Isaac, I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife for the daughters of Heth like these from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? So how does she bill, how does she sell kicking Isaac, or now to Isaac, having Jacob leave and go back to Haran? What does she say to Isaac as to why this is actually going to go down?
Get a wife.
He needs to go get a wife. He needs to go get a godly woman, right? Now notice, how long did Rebecca think that Jacob would be there in verse 44? A few days, right? And what ultimately would happen? What was her hope? Esau will mellow out and he will forget. Jacob is going to be there for 20 years. Esau's never going to forget this moment. We're going to see a crazy story when Jacob now comes back into the land 20 years later. Rebecca is going to die before he comes back. This is the last time he will see his mother alive. So this story has ended up in a train wreck. And God is going to put Jacob exactly where God wants Jacob. The trickster, the conniver, the deceiver is going to go meet the one person on the face of the earth that can trick and deceive better than him. And he's about to go get schooled by Uncle Laban. Okay? Nobody is as good as Laban. And Jacob's going to learn all your pop and sizzle and your ability to manipulate situations for your advantage, that ain't going to work here. And Jacob is about to get played by Laban, and God is going to teach him a 20-year lesson in his own wilderness and deal with him. So God's got to work the Jacob out of Jacob before he can use Jacob. Okay? So 28, Isaac calls Jacob, 28:1, blesses him, charges him, and says, hey, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Go, just like we said, arise, go to Padan Aram, go back to Haran, where Abraham kind of made the pit stop in his journey to Canaan. Verse 3, may God Almighty bless you, may he be fruitful, may he multiply you. Isaac's kind of come to terms with the fact that, well, I gave him the blessing, so it is what it is at this point. May he give you the blessing of Abraham to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land. So he sends him off with basically the extension of his blessing and says, man, go. So head up there and go to Uncle Laban and go hang out with him. Okay, pick up in verse 6.
Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take to himself a wife there, that when he blessed him, he charged him, saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan.
All right, so I saw my brother go out, and he's going to go take a godly wife. Verse 8, here's what I'm going to do.
So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac, and Esau went to Ishmael and married beside the wives that he had said,
Mahalath,
the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaloth.
Right, so he goes to Ishmael and says, this is going to make my dad unhappy? Fantastic. I will marry another ungodly woman to basically thumb his nose at his dad, if you will. Like, the heck with you. I don't care what you want from me. So you see a defiant, hard Esau, and he's going to be hot mad for a long time at Jacob, and he's in disobedience of his parents' wishes, obviously, here, and goes and marries now another pagan wife. Okay. Now, verse 10, watch now what happens to Jacob as he's leaving home.
Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went to Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there, because the sun had set, and he had took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place.
Now, think about this for a second, okay? This is the first time we see Jacob away from home. He's a mama's boy, right? This is not Bear Grylls. This is not his brother who's, like, totally comfortable camping in the wilderness and hunting stuff. This is Jacob, and God has got him now away from home for the very first time. He is by himself. He is alone, and he's literally sleeping with a rock underneath his head for a pillow, okay? That's a bad day, okay? God has got you in a difficult spot when just like a day's journey before, you're at home, you've got comfort, you're surrounded by the things that you need, And now God has him by himself. Now watch what happens here in verse 12 when God gets this kid alone and now can deal with him without the distractions of life.
He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac, the land on which you lie. I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and use the east and to the north to go to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed.
Okay, what is that called? What is that sentence or that section that we just read? It's an extension of what? So we saw in chapter 12. It's the Abrahamic covenant, right? I'm going to bless you. You're the guy. It went from Abraham to your father Isaac, and now you're the guy, Jacob. I am going to bless you. The extension will go through you. Behold, verse 15, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. Why would God show up to Jacob in the middle of nowhere and say, I am here with you? Yeah. Does he feel abandoned right now? Yeah. And God says, man, I know how you feel, and it's going to be hard. And your next 20 years, by the way, are not going to be pleasant. But I am here. I am in the midst of your pain. I'm in the midst of your difficulty. I'm allowing you to go through this because you need to go through it. And we got some work to do on you yet, okay? Jacob is going to enter this situation with Laban as an immature, deceptive young man. And he's going to leave very, very different. The school of Laban will teach him much, and it's in God's hand that he's going to learn when he does. So it is a powerful story, but this is the beginning of it. And I think God is doing this on purpose at the very get-go to say, hey, you're the guy. I will bless you. So Esau is not getting the blessing. This is my desire. And regardless of how alone, abandoned, in the middle of nowhere you feel, I am here. Okay? A ladder descending from heaven to where you are, and angels descending and ascending to heaven, the stairway to heaven, right? That is what I think God is communicating. And in verse 16, Jacob wakes up and says, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. I thought I was abandoned, and here is God in my, at this point in his life, one of his most difficult days, and God shows up. Okay? Yeah, Andres. One of the epistle writers?
Yeah.
It's mentioned in John 1. Jesus talks about it. John 1:43, when he's calling one of the disciples. I'd have to think if it's a reference to that in the epistles. I can't remember offhand. Okay? But yeah, this story is mentioned again in the New Testament, at least there, specific to this story. Okay? So, promise is given to him. Jacob now wakes up, and watch what he says in verse 17 after he says, God's here.
He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven.
So he names that place literally the house of God. Verse 19, he called the name Bethel. Bet means house, El means God, house of God. It used to be called Luz, the text tells us, but Jacob renames it Bethel. Okay, and this is going to be his, like, Bethel for Jacob is going to be, I don't know, spiritual awake, I don't know what you call it, but like this is going to be a significant place where he goes, that is where God met me. That was a significant city, a significant time in my life. It's like the Oak of Moreh for Abraham. Man, when all goes bad, this is the place I go back to because that is where God met with me. So Bethel is going to hold a special place in the life of Jacob for numerous reasons. One is yet 20 years in the future, but we'll see this play a significant role in his life, if you will. Okay, so he wakes up from his dream, realizes God is there, names the place the house of God. Verse 18, he arose early in the morning, took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. So he makes an altar to God, and this is the agreement that he and God make in verse 20. Listen to this.
He called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be here with me and keep me on this journey that I take, and give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God.
Walk me through that. What is Jacob saying?
If he does X, Y, and Z, then he's God.
God, if you do all these things that I want you to do, okay? If I pull on the knobs of the vending machine and you give me everything I want, then what?
Then,
you will be my God. What do you think God says about that? Okay. All right. You want to try that? Let's try that. Let's see how that goes, right? You see a very, this is an immature, if you will, a conditional. This is not a unilateral covenant. It's not a covenant at all. But he's basically saying, God, if you take care of me and you do all these things, then I'll follow you. You'll be my God. Now, there's a part of that that's true because he's listening to what God just said. I'm going to take care of you. I'll be your God. Don't worry about it. I got it handled, right? So he's saying, okay, God, if all that's true and you do those things, then you'll be my God. But he's not saying, look, God, I'm utterly committed to you. No matter what happens, I'm in. He's not there yet. So we're going to see, again, this young man's faith mature. And it needs to. Okay, this is a very conditional thing. Okay, so he makes this agreement with God. And the stone, which I have set in verse 22, as a pillar, will be God's house. And all that you give to me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So I will tithe, I will give you from my first fruits. But first, I need to see you act in a manner consistent with how I think God should act. And then I will give you what you're due. Okay? So this is the Jacob that we see early on in his life, 40 years old, as he leaves now to go to Haran, to go to the school of Uncle Laban. Okay, and we'll pick up on the rest of that story tomorrow.
I was just going to ask if that was the first time that anyone established sort of tithe.
We see it earlier with, remember the Melchizedek story with Abraham? We see it mentioned there in Genesis 14, that tithe and the tenth and who gives to who. So we've seen this before, but we haven't seen it many times. So yeah, but Genesis 14 was the first. Okay? All right, guys. Enjoy your Friday. We'll see you. Enjoy Thursday. We'll see you Friday. How about that? Fabulous.